Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and a very warm welcome to you all as we discuss the perils of AI and where this is taking us, the journey of AI and where it's taking education amongst the rest of the industries that we are preparing our children for. I'm very excited to introduce Dr. Benjamin Rossman from Witwatersrand University. Professor Rossman is a professor of machine learning and robotics in the School of Computer Science and Applied Mathematics at WIT. He is a director of WIT's Machine Learning and Neural Discovery Institute. He's also a director of Robotics, Autonomous Intelligence and Learning Laboratory. He is a co-founder of Lalapa AI and Deep Learning Indaba, and just recently became a fellow of the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research in Learning in Machines and Brains. So a very warm welcome to you, Prof.
Thank you.
It's been on the list for a long time to get you here at EduInc to talk to you about all of this. The first time we actually ran into you, you were presenting at Apple to a bunch of private school heads, and it was right after the inception of ChatGPT. I think it had raised its head in about the November, and this was the January or the February of the next year. And that conversation was about how to use ChatGPT to make a good teacher a great teacher. Tonight's conversation is not going to be that. So any teachers who are looking to get tips on ChatGPT, exit stage left. Tonight's conversation is going to be a much bigger conversation about AI and how it's affecting all of us. If anybody else in the room feels like me, I'm a lay person, I'm trying to wrap my head around all of this. Can we start with just some basic terminology so that we are all on the same page in terms of vocabulary?
Let's do it.
Generative AI.
Firstly, it's great to be here. Thank you so much. A real honor to be with all of you. What is generative AI? Maybe I should take a step back and talk about what is AI and some of the categories there that we think about. AI, artificial intelligence, is kind of a academic discipline that's been around since the term was coined in the 50s, like trying to build intelligent machines. Well, there were always two kind of angles to us. On the one side, the more computer science, electrical engineering angle was about building machines that are able to solve difficult problems. And then kind of on the biological side is kind of an exercise in trying to understand better how the most complicated object we know of in the universe, which is the brain, how that functions. So this is what the field of AI is about. It's quite a broad field. It covers a whole lot of different topics, things like robotics, for example. But really in recent years, in the last couple of decades, the big powerhouse kind of sub-discipline under AI has been machine learning. And machine learning is this idea that, well, as computer scientists, we're very lazy people. It's very hard for us to describe to machines how to solve certain problems. But instead, we can give them examples of things and get the machine to figure out how to solve the problem itself. Kind of toy example, if you were trying to code into a machine how to tell the difference between a dog or a cat, this is a fairly difficult thing to do. Right? How would you even go about explaining it at the level that you could detect any arbitrary animal, like what it would be? But on the other hand, it's quite easy to go out and collect like thousands of pictures of dogs and cats.
Right.
And if you can get the machine to figure out the rules for you, that's a lot easier in this case than putting in those rules yourself. So that's what machine learning is about. Now, there's this area of really machine learning that's kind of about generative, it's this generative way of thinking, which is now known as Gen AI or generative AI. And that's really kind of at its core, what that's about is understanding the data well enough that you're able to kind of get the machine to replicate or give you feasible examples of that data. So, you know, on the one hand, you might have a system that could tell you if something is written in English or in Japanese, right? Yeah. And if it just told you that, that's not generative. But if it's able to generate text that's English or Japanese, then it would be a generative model. This comes down to some of the mathematics underneath. That's really what it's about. And so where that's kind of captured the world by storm is, turns out very useful functionality is being able to write and create images and create music.
Right.
And all that like act of creating something means you understand it well enough to be able to synthesize versions of that.
Because that's kind of where we are in the ChatGPT space as we understand it at the moment. And I'm using ChatGPT as a fairly generic term to accommodate all the different types that we're dealing with. let's move on to where we are going at what seems to be quite a fast pace, because we're not done.
Not at all.
With where things stand at the moment. And I think this is one of the things I'd like to touch on at some point. The fact that in education, it feels like, you know, we're quite a conservative industry. So we might be in the trap of thinking, oh, well, we've got ChatGPT and we have Perplexity and we have all of these tools available to us to make us better at what we do. And because of the way we understand the world to work and how it has historically always worked, oh, this is great. They're going to spend the next couple of decades refining ChatGPT and we're going to get better at ChatGPT. But that's not actually the case at all. Please correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm just going from the research that I've done. But it would seem that, and there seems to be a lot of debate at how quickly this is moving, but ChatGPT or these large language models, as I understand it, that we are working with currently, are actually just the crawling phases of where this is all going. Well, some people are saying within the next year, some people saying 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, we're going to have artificial general intelligence. And then apparently very quickly after that, artificial super intelligence. So could you talk about those two?
I mean, there's a lot to talk about there. Start thinking about the rate of growth of the field. I found it interesting, kind of early 2023-ish, start talking to a lot of people in schools and working with people in many different industries. And everyone kind of has this view of, okay, AI has happened. Mm. And now how do we deal with the new normal or something like that? And it's been something that I feel like kind of a big duty on people in the field to say, that's the slowest you'll ever see it change. The field's been around since the 50s, but it's always been kind of slowly simmering in the background. Many of us have been trying to wave some flags and point out that people should be paying more attention to it. Mm-hmm. But apparently, I don't know, you need crypto to collapse and then silly image generating tools to go viral on the internet before people start noticing. AI is the fastest growing field in human history. Estimates are something like 500 academic papers published a day in the field. There's something like 70,000 companies that are AI companies in the world at the moment, and new ones being founded daily.
Yeah.
It's wild. We've never seen anything like this. Like when people are talking about the investments, it's in like the trillions of dollars.
Yeah.
I'm not biased at all, but I think it's the most important thing humankind has ever done.
Okay, we'll take that at face value.
So when we talk about this, and you've mentioned artificial general intelligence and artificial super intelligence. Now, these are things people talk about that tends to get the hair standing up on the back of people's necks and often shut down a lot of the conversations about what's happening. But I think it's very important stuff to talk about.
Yeah.
So look back 20 years or so. And when we taught AI, there were usually two different things that people would talk about. They talk about narrow AI versus general AI.
Right.
And this is like an AI that's like good at a very specific thing versus that's kind of generally intelligent. Okay. And there have been a lot of discussions, technical, philosophical, over the years about kind of what all this means. But the upshot of this is, if we know we've got machines now that can beat the best chess players that have ever existed. But like typically, if you change the rules of the game, you tell them they're playing a different game, like they'll fail miserably. Or you ask it to now drive a car and it will say, you know, rook to e7. That's not general at all. But I think one of the driving questions in the field since its inception has been this idea of generality. And that's very much drawn from the way the mysteries of how we work as living creatures, and particularly humans, that, you know, the same human is able to play chess and drive a car and make a cup of coffee and have a conversation and sing a song. And, you know, all these different things are kind of performed by the same squishy blob of jelly. This is a super interesting technical question. Like, how does that even happen? And so this has been kind of the grand challenge of the field kind of since the beginning. So what everyone's trying to build are machines that are more and more general. And it's really only in the last 10, 15 years that's started to happen at any reasonable scale. And I think that's why ChatGPT and friends have become so popular now, is because of the kind of broad diversity of things they're able to do. Everybody, no matter what industry they're in, has some use case that they're really fond of and that they like to brag about. Like, ooh, I found this cool thing I can do with it, right? And it's because of that, that's the generality that we're starting to see the glimpses of coming through that makes it exciting. Because the tools haven't been built with each of those use cases in place.
Okay.
Now, this is kind of part of the way we've been thinking about machine learning in recent years. This is part of the way they're trained, but we don't have to go kind of use case by use case figuring out how to solve it, which is how things were done 15 years ago. This is where the race is now. Now, there's huge upshots, or like the implications to this are, I think, really profound, and we'll probably talk about a fair bit. So artificial general intelligence, there's many different definitions of what this is, but it roughly talks to like a point where machines are able to do anything that a human can do at like a human level of competence.
Okay.
Now, there's different definitions. My personal feeling is you can define it however you want. They're all, you know, within a small amount of time, if it hits one, it will hit whatever other one you want. And artificial superintelligence is kind of this point, again, many different definitions, where like an AI system is equivalent in intelligence, again, for however you want to define it, we can talk about these things, to maybe the whole planet of humans. These are rough landmarks that people talk about in different ways. And then questions are all about, when do we hit these things? Will we hit these things? And what does it mean when we hit these things?
Where does agentic AI fit in there?
Okay, so agentic AI is a different kind of modality of thinking about AI. It's actually a term I'm not a fan of because I was doing what's now called agentic AI a long time ago, and I just hate that it's been turned into an adjective, but it just annoys some other part of me. So when you look at something like ChatGPT, its job, like really fundamentally under the hood, what it's doing as a large language model, its job is to predict the next word. Like that's the entire point of the exercise. Is it's a next word predictor.
Okay.
So when it's writing stuff, it's like just predicting the next word it should write each time based on everything it's learned about how language works and how grammar works and what humans like in general and what this human likes specifically and in the context of the conversation we've been having and all these kinds of things. But again, like its entire job is just predicting one word at a time. The kind of notion of an agent is something that has agency. So we talk about this as a system that's able to take actions. Now, these actions might be generate words, but it might be move your arm. It might be make a cup of coffee, like depending on how you're thinking about it. But it's typically got the capability of affecting more than just one space, like just language, for example. So typically the way people think now about agentic AI, what they typically mean is you've got these systems that are able to instantiate other kinds of systems. So you might have one that's trying to, I don't know, manage your social media strategy. And it instantiates another AI to generate a post for you to throw up on Instagram, and a different AI that will generate an image, and a different AI that's going to come up with a, figure out the scheduling of this. So it's busy launching other versions of it that will solve different sub-problems. Typically, the aspect that we think about this in this space is about the effects of these decisions.
Yeah.
So like there's an aspect of sequential decision-making. If I'm going to, like, if I've got choices ahead of me, what is the right thing to do? Not just in terms of predicting one at a time, but thinking about the consequences down the line and strategizing from that perspective.
Yeah, I was listening to Cody Sanchez's podcast. Somebody had done a study where they had taken AI to see if it could run a business for you completely autonomously. And I think they used Facebook Marketplace because they felt it was fairly simple. And they said that it was only at about 40% capability at that point. Would they be using agentic AI to do that at that point?
Again, it's basically, you can think of it as a system of different AIs that are interacting together.
So what about timeframes? If we are looking at AGI as AI that can pretty much do what a human can do, probably in a lot less time and possibly a lot more effectively, just because they're not going to take leave and they're not going to get sick and they're not going to need to sleep or eat, etc. Quite soon after that, if we go along with what Eric Schmitz has been talking about, he reckons within 3 years of AGI we'll have ASI, which is when your AI is cleverer than the sum of human intelligence. All human intelligence.
Yeah.
And that's a little alarming. So I'm hearing timeframes from him and I'm hearing timeframes from all these different CEOs and they're all in the industry. What is your opinion?
So you know what they say, making predictions is hard, particularly when it's about the future. I mean, this is the big question and this is something that's hotly debated everywhere. So don't like to put much stock in the distinction between AGI and ASI. Okay. You know, in the same way as the different definitions, I'm not really bothered about that. If you were to go to, I don't know, let's rewind to mid, I don't know, let's say 2021 or so.
Mm.
Go to any of the big academic conferences and you ask people, when are we going to hit AGI? Mm. Right? People always ask these questions.
Mm.
Maybe people would give estimates. 25 years had been quite a common answer for a number of years. But, you know, ranging anywhere from, say, 25 years up. I mean, there's still some people that think we'll never get there, but I think that's a bit silly. And then suddenly, if you look at kind of the same groups of people, you know, now the estimates would be 3 years, 5 years, maybe some would be 10. And like, these are the kinds of discussions that people are having. And I think a lot of that is driven by just honestly, as a community, being surprised at how effectively kind of the technology underpinning these large language mm. models, how well it actually works and how well it generalizes. It's definitely not, doesn't do everything we'd like it to do, but it's a very, the generalizability and the impact that it has across many different disciplines is huge. So, you know, personally, I feel that there's a point there. We might not exactly see it when it happens, just for various reasons we can talk about, but I think we're looking in the 3 to 5 year range before we get AIs that are capable of basically doing anything that a human can do better than a human can do it.
Why would we not see that?
Because it's going to happen in research labs,
okay.
Particularly corporate research labs. I think there'll be certain decisions made that we're not aware of about what to do with these things. They're not going to teleport straight into our labs.
Sure.
You know, already they're going to be steering a lot of the conversation before we even are aware that they exist, basically.
I'd like to talk about some of the barriers, but before I do that, I'm going to swing it back around to education. You know, you're saying 3 to 6 years, but even if we are looking at that time frame, even if it's the 6 year time frame, what that means for us is that students we currently have in grade 7, by the time they matriculate, they are living in the world of AGI. My current grade 8 cohort, by the time they matriculate, and most definitely by the time they finish their undergrad degree, they're in that world. Now, we are struggling to find a vocabulary that allows us to quantify that world. We know that there's going to be massive job loss, but we also know that there will be jobs created. That's how humankind has always operated. By 2030, 92 million jobs displaced, gone, never to be seen again. But 170 million will have been created. We just don't know what they're going to be yet. How do we take our grade 8s or our grade 9s who are trying to do subject choices right now and have sensible conversations about a world we can't conceptualize?
So with all due respect to many of my esteemed colleagues around the world, I think that's a load of garbage. I mean, there's always been this kind of talking point from the big consultancies of, for every job automated away, 1.7 new jobs will be created, which is kind of in line with the numbers you quoted there. Much of the discourse around this question, like, shows a profound fear, a profound lack of creativity, mm-hmm. a profound lack of understanding, and hubris of being human. If we go back to the principles, right? So what are we talking about here? We're talking about a field where the aim of the field is to build machines that are better than humans at everything. And we say everything, we don't just mean like, you know, like in the movies, the cold calculating machines, but the humans defeat them by the power of love. No. We're talking about things that are like across the board better than humans. That means they're more empathetic than humans. They're more emotional than humans. Maybe they feel and experience in a deeper, more profound way than humans. They are better at physical activities than humans. They're more creative and poetic than humans. They're better at maths than humans. Like, we're talking about, without failure, across the board, humans being obsolete. That is literally the point of the field. For better or worse, that's like what the entire current arms race is trying to build. Okay? Now.
Okay, that's alarming.
Exactly.
That's alarming.
So when we talk about this, okay, we then say, okay, a bunch of jobs are going to be disappear off the face of the earth, but new ones are being created. I'm always left wondering, what on earth are these new ones? So humans have two spheres of labor that we've always worked in. We do physical labor and we do kind of cognitive labor. Mm-hmm. And kind of in previous industrial revolutions, there's been a general shift of humanity from the physical to the cognitive.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of correlates with what we see as our most esteemed jobs and things, is like the more heady you can be, the more you sit at your desk and hurt your back, like the better like life is for you or something. That's the realm that we kind of aspire to. So there's always been this, you know, these discussions about you want to upskill people. Implies that there's this hierarchy of things get better, and you want to, more training means you're better and you're higher up the hierarchy. But also that means you're doing more and more intellectually, you know, intellectual type tasks that maybe fewer and fewer people higher up are able to actually do. Turns out all of these things are at risk of automation, mm-hmm. right? So now if you're building systems that the exact same system can speak all the languages and can write poetry and can write, you know, maybe it's never gone through a breakup, but if it's read every angsty breakup letter on the internet, it probably understands it better than you do. If it's got all this kind of experience, it's read every book on how to use Excel. It can write the books on how to use Excel. It can process all the YouTube videos on this. It can also do all of this 200,000 times faster than any human, let alone consume every bit of information ever generated. What on earth is a human going to do in the face of that? Like, so I'm always left wondering, what are these imaginary jobs that people in their hubris like to think humans will magically always be able to do, that these machines that we can literally see trying to zoom past us on all these dimensions already as we sit here, already it can code better than I can. Mm. It can write better poetry than I can. Like, and this has happened over the space of, we take the whole tale into account, but really over the space of the last couple of years that this has happened.
Yeah.
Right. Again, the slowest change in this technology we'll ever see.
Has just happened.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And again, I'm left wondering, like, where are these, you know, 170 million new jobs that are going to be created? Because to me, that doesn't make sense.
Well, it's interesting that you speak about this hubris, human hubris. The human hubris and the fear. It's been interesting to talk to people about this and see where their heads are at, because it definitely speaks to both of those things. Over the last couple of months, knowing that this talk was coming up, I've been asking, just in passing conversation, saying to friends, and I've spoken to one in banking, and I've spoken to a friend in IT, supply chain management for a delivery company, and every single one, I've just in passing said, and how do you think AI is going to affect your industry? And every single one of them has said the same thing. They've said, not as much as people think it's going to. And it blows my mind, because I want to engage in the conversation at that point and say, but it already has. Because in my mind, that speaks directly either to the hubris or to the fear. It's either fight or flight reaction to deep fear for the industry that they're in, because they can't imagine themselves in a position of being completely obsolete, or maybe for their children.
And we've never seen this as a species before,
exactly.
Right?
We've
been the dominant species on this planet for as far back as anyone in this room can remember.
Yeah.
And
by the time we hit ASR, the machines are smarter than we are. We are the second
yep.
most intelligent beings on the planet. Human beings don't do well with that.
No. And psychologically, the challenge is, you know, we're looking at an exponential curve in technology.
Yeah.
And I keep saying it's weird to feel like you're actually living through one, because brains don't notice these things. Humans always tend to kind of overestimate the near future and underestimate the distant future. And that's okay. because you're kind of extrapolating on a straight line where things are doing this. So you think there's a bigger jump now. So you tend to be disappointed in the short term, completely blown away in the long term, because you're just unable to take that into account. And I think people look at their ChatGPT and they say, oh, I can't see this coming to work every day and doing my job. Like, of course, because it's several generations behind the thing that will do that. That's not the thing that's taking your job. That's just generating training data for the thing that's going to take your job. It's just going to do that in the next 3 to 5 years. I mean, already in the last few years, we've seen going from typing to it to talking to
it
to maybe being integrated into all the sensors in your house or your building. And like all of these things slowly becoming more and more agentic, as we discussed earlier, mm-hmm. With more and more capabilities to change things in the world. Doesn't really have to. It's already, there's more than enough studies of how easily these things can manipulate people to get them to do what they need done in the real world. And again, these are just the early stages of this technology. But again, I think it's worth trying to kind of speculate and philosophize and decide what we should be doing, not so much based on what we see the technology looking like today, or, you know, 3 weeks ago, what that trajectory looks like, and kind of what the aims of the field are, and where the resources are being invested in developing the technology. One of the big kind of fears that people talk about, or the kind of takeoff points is now that AI is being used more and more in AI research. As it is, I mean, I can go into it, but like, we don't really understand how AI works. And I'll come back to this in a second. As AI is more and more involved in researching and developing the next generation of AI, the gap between what humans understand and what's actually happening is going to grow.
Yes.
Which also makes it difficult for us to make sure our values are inculcated into these things and so on. This is a huge problem.
You hit on something, and I was actually looking at this earlier today, and it was Geoffrey Hinton. And an interviewer said to him, they were having the conversation about AGI and where it's going, and an interviewer said, does humanity know what it's doing with this? And his answer was, no. You sort of take a pause at that point, but he carried on with the interview, and he said, they absolutely will have self-awareness and consciousness. The interviewer said, but how can it get to that point when we, the humans, designed it? And he said, because we didn't design it. This is not a product of human endeavor. We designed the learning algorithm, and then it took it from there. And that's when things get scary. If we haven't brought the values in at the right moment, we're in deep trouble. Listening to a lot of these people talking about AI, for the first time, it feels like, you know, previous to COVID, we were having lots of conversations about EdTech and how EdTech could revolutionize education. And we spoke about EdTech alone. I don't feel that we can have conversations about AI and how to integrate it into not just education, but our worlds, without the philosophy conversation. Because if we don't do that, then yeah, we are in deep trouble. Eric Schmidt, he did a TED talk. He just gave a scenario and he said, the problem we have is that the race is literally whoever gets there 1 minute before the other has won the race globally and gets to define all these things. We can talk about, as we were saying, the barriers to get this going, the regulations of governments, the tariffs between America and China, and how that it creates strangleholds and bottlenecks getting the parts in to build what they need to get the data centers, because apparently we've run out of data. This was a thing. I didn't know it happened, but apparently we've run out of data to feed the AIs, and now we need data centers because that's essentially what they are being fueled on and power and all these kind of things. But he says, we are both going towards ASI, and we're going there as fast as we possibly can. But you're 6 months ahead of me, and I'm a bad guy. What am I going to do to you?
Try and stop me.
I'm going to try and stop you. But your AI is already good enough that I can't corrupt your code. I can't put spies in, because everything you're doing, you've already factored all of that in. So what is the only option I'm left with? Bomb your data centers, and I'm a bad guy. So it's when we hear these things that the fear increases. How do we handle that? How do we have conversations where we can keep a positive mindset around this, and we can keep saying this is a good thing for humanity? Really, have we had a conversation yet where it does feel like a good thing for humanity? How do we make it a good thing for humanity? And how do we have that conversation without bringing ethics and philosophy into the conversation? This is not just about technology anymore.
It's super difficult because this is like a paradigm shift of a moment. Like, we don't know what the future looks like. The big challenge is to make sure we steer it in the right direction. There was a quote from way back that basically said, if we get AI right, we become immortal, and we get it wrong, we go extinct. And we got one shot to get it right.
Good.
Thinking around this, like at WITS, we've just launched what we call the Mind Institute, the Machine Intelligence and Neural Discovery Institute, which is kind of a radically interdisciplinary institute, similar to some others that exist in the world, but really unique globally, where we've brought together, and I'm directing this institute, we brought together at the moment 34 academics from across WITS, but we're growing that, we're making it pan-African. You know, only about a third of those people come from AI. It's an institute of artificial and natural intelligence. So we've brought together anyone who has any kind of skin in the game around that whole cluster. So that means there's neuroanatomists and neuroscientists and behavioral psychologists and evolutionary scientists, but also people in the creative arts, also philosophers, also ethicists and people in policy and all these different disciplines, and kind of brought this cohort together of leading academics to have discussions and work on things ranging from new technology to new frameworks for governance to new economic policies. One angle is to make sure that Africa is taking, you know, a seat at the big table, but also to help try and steer this in the right direction. And because the future shouldn't just be written, I definitely don't want the future written by computer scientists. That would be a terrible idea.
Good to know. And what are the chances of that having a meaningful impact when the average layperson tries to research with what is happening? And, I'll take myself as an example, trying to upskill myself, be aware of what's going on so that I can have a view on how I'm going to continue educating the children who come through my school. Tiny little micro level, but I need to have good understanding of what this is looking like going forward over the next 5, 10, 20 plus years. That's my job. But when I do the research, I get the big conversations with a lot of fear-mongering going on there. And I need to try and make sense of all of this in a field that I'm not a data scientist. I've never done machine learning or, you know, that sort of thing. How do I not run away screaming, going, well, I'm completely overwhelmed, so I'm going to bury my head in the sand and just hope that everything goes well? Because that's not a responsible approach. It's not a particularly informed approach, and it's pretty irresponsible when you're dealing with younger generations. How do we make sure that we are not swayed by these big voices? The other problem is, of course, these guys are not worried about the ethics. They're just worried about the race and being first. And if they need to compromise on the ethics to win the race, I have no doubt they're going to do that personally. So how do we make sure that conversations with younger people about the ethics of the situation happen properly, and that agencies like this have a real voice, an impactful voice going forward? Should we be counseling the kids to rather steer their energies towards forums like that? Because quite honestly, why would I tell a grade 9 right now to go and do a BCom degree? I feel almost irresponsible doing that. I would rather tell him, go and get a seat at that table and make meaningful change there.
So I would tend to agree with that sentiment. There's a lot of big questions that we don't know the answers to. We're overwhelmed and we're panicking about this.
Okay, kind that's of, not encouraging.
No, it's not at all. From our side, the first thing is go look for other people who can contribute different angles to the conversation. Mm-hmm. And that's partially why I spend a lot of time trying to engage with different audiences around this topic, because, you know, we need kind of the collective of human wisdom here to help and steer the conversation. Now, there's many conversations that need to be steered. Yes. And again, we don't know how things are going to pan out in many different ways. But something that's, I think, really important is to be connected to different kinds of experts. So, you know, you'll often get, you know, when you talk about like there's a bit of a caricatured situation, you know, talk about the ethics questions, right? What you often find is you've got computer scientists talking about these kind of ethics questions and the impact of the technology on society. They don't really know how society works or how ethics works.
Okay.
Or you have ethicists that are talking about what AI is going to do and have absolutely no idea, like have a ton of misconceptions about how AI works. I mean, I recently had some discussions with some political lobbyists in Brussels. Basically, their view of how ChatGPT works was like completely wrong. Essentially, it's like doing Google searches.
Oh dear.
And it, like, even the analogies were wrong for, like, you know, the technology we're talking about looks a lot more like a brain than what you think of as a computer.
Right.
This is why we don't know what it's doing, because it's got billions of neurons and there's synapses between the neurons and there's the analog of electrochemical signals being passed through these billions of brain cells all the time, and you can't actually figure out what that means. The way we do that with humans is we put them in fMRIs and hope we can make sense of it, right? But like, it's the same kind of levels of complexity. And I think if you've got the right model for understanding what this means, you can make better decisions. Now, if we think about like this, let's just talk about, you know, you were talking about like what should kids be doing and focusing on. Let's kind of focus in on the future of work, that kind of situation, which I think is one of the key challenges we're facing. What does this mean? Well, my view here is that if we do put our head in the sand and say, no, things will all work out fine, maybe they will in the long term. But like, you know, what I see happening is more and more people are going to get either retrenched or not replaced, or there's just going to be a smaller demand for various skills, and this is going to be happening across kind of every sector in parallel. It's already happening very slowly at first, but then people say, oh, look, but some jobs were created, and they take that to mean, no, don't worry about that. And it sounds a little bit like the, it can't be global warming because it snowed somewhere. You know, it's that kind of thing. We're looking at the macro picture here. And if you have the view that, like, yeah, it's all going to work out, there'll just be jobs we can't even imagine yet, right? Again, maybe, like, we don't know what the future looks like. But, you know, if you just kind of accept that, then it is plausible we end up at a point where, you know, in the space of a few months, in some developed countries, you end up getting an uptick of unemployment of like 5 to 8% or something in just a few months. And the social safety net can't handle that. Civilization could collapse. It seems not a great outcome.
No.
I'm not a huge fan of this. on the other hand, maybe we could take other views and we could say, you know, something that I've been thinking about a bit. I'm not an economist. I'm not like a sociologist. But, you know, maybe this is a good thing. Maybe working for a living is immoral and we shouldn't do it. But we've always had to do it because humans are the ones who get the work done. But like, if you really think about it, you've got to do a thing which is bad for you, probably emotionally or psychologically or physically. But if you don't do that, then you and your family don't get to eat next month, right? Which is kind of barbaric if you put it in that terms, but that's what like all of humanity has been about. So maybe we shouldn't do that. Maybe we should instead figure out how to get all these crazy machines that are going to be so good at everything to do all the shitty work for us. Instead, we figure out what that society looks like. Now, there's a difference here between kind of accepting what might be happening and trying to plan ahead and say, this might require a paradigm shift, rather than saying, let's see what happens and there might be revolutions along the way.
Yeah.
And then you can be quite specific about questions. You can say, okay, then how will people get, you know, whatever their currency is to buy food? There's a very well-defined problem you can think about. Or where will people find value in life if they're not working for a living? Well, there's a very specific question we can have discussions about, but it's about taking some of these framings, challenging what the framing is, what might happen, and saying, okay, how would this affect some aspect? Now let's have a very specific discussion on this while other people think about other aspects. And that's what I would like to see more happening.
So back to the simultaneous conversations, we can't separate them. That this is what's happening in the AI space and leave the philosophy and the ethics on the side. We can't do that.
You don't want to take that from the perspective of, well, you know, in the future, our smartphones will be way smarter. Because then, like, the world in that framing looks identical to the world today, except, I don't know, you browse the internet faster or something. And then people don't realize what the implications are. You've got to actually sit with the technologists and say, where is this going?
Yeah.
And then think again, what are the implications in the domain that I care about?
Yeah. Because these are big questions to ask. You're going to have the argument on the one side, as you're saying, labor is almost barbaric. And if the machines can do it so much better than we can anyway, let them. And in whatever format that looks, that suddenly now we move very heavily or even more so into consumerism to keep the economy moving so that we can have this leisure time to be so much more, whatever it might be, purposeful, creative, pursue passion projects because the machines are doing the work. But the flip side of that argument is always going to be, but the human being, the way our brains are wired, is for purpose, for labor. We need to feel worthwhile, a sense of worth. And we generally find our sense of worth through our engagement with community, societies, that sort of thing. You read the studies, the psychological studies on the people who are most isolated, atomization. One chap talks about atomization. When we isolate ourselves and turn inward upon ourselves, it becomes harder and harder to then re-engage with community. And we lose our sense of self-regulation at that point. Pull that thread and you've got Lord of the Flies. That's not ideal. But then you pull the other thread and you've got even if you look at society right now, we actually do less labor than any time previously.
Don't tell my emails that.
In terms of, we keep talking about work-life balance and everything else, but if you look historically and you actually look at the amount of hard labor hours put into things, we are laboring less now than ever before. We have access to more food, sustenance.
Well, for certain sectors of the population.
Yes, I'm generalizing. We have access to so much more. And yet, as a human, as a race, we are more depressed, more anxious, spending more money, there's more suicide. And we can say, yes, but the population's grown. So, of course, these stats will go up, but the ratio does not match. So there's more to keep us busy and happy, and yet we're more unhappy. We are more disconnected. I don't agree with the argument of, oh, well, the government can just give everyone a stipend, a monthly stipend to maintain consumerism or economy through consumerism. And we're going to have all this lovely leisure time to be purposeful. No, human beings take the path of least resistance. Our brains are like water or electricity. There will be more people sitting on the couch playing Xbox. That's it. That's what will happen, in my opinion. Not a great outlook in that regard.
This is where I say, you know, in that regard, I think there's the two problems. The one is about the money, could be a universal basic income, something like that. The other is really where you find your sense of value from. Again, this is something we should think about much more deeply because it has the opportunity to be something beautiful, right? So the aristocracy of old seemed to manage quite interestingly with when people retire. These are big challenges they face. And, you know, there's courses you can take on how should I rethink my life now that I'm retired. And people that invest in doing things one way can say that they're completely happy, and other people can be completely depressed. But also, I'm not saying you don't do the thing that gives you value. Like, no matter what your job is, not every part of it gives you value, right? Focus on the things you enjoy doing. If that's interacting with people, spend all your time doing that interaction, but you're just not getting paid for it. It's just giving you personal satisfaction. I don't know what the answer is, but these are the conversations that I think are open to huge percentages of the population. You don't have to be the technologist. You just have to have the framing of where might the technology be going to entertain these conversations. And I think these are what we need to explore. We need a radical explosion in the diversity of ideas we're looking at, and not just taking this model of, oh, it's always going to be business as usual and things are never going to change. And we need to embrace that and do it pretty urgently.
I'm wondering how much pushback humans will give in a space where they feel that they are being displaced. I believe that pushback will come from the value that they perceive in human relationship. There was something I did at the end of last year that became another little thought experiment. The grade 11 English class got a question saying, given the global teacher crisis, EdUnk is struggling to get an English teacher. So we've decided that you're going to have an AI-driven robot who is going to teach your English. And this robot will have the features of a woman. She's going to be dressed as a woman, features of a woman. Will be able to turn her head when she hears your voice. It looks like she's engaging with you. She'll be able to move her arms, but she won't be able to walk around in the room, and she's not going to have changing facial expressions. The benefit of this is that you can also have this robot tutor you any subject at any given time. So it's not just an English teacher. Now this is a resource on hand for whatever subject you would like. They could choose. They could write a letter to the head, or they could write a speech about it to the parents, or whatever. And what was really interesting was 100% of those students didn't want it. We're such a techie school. We have kids who are so, tech is just an extension of their own existence. Every single one of them said no. For most of them, what was really fascinating to me was when they said no, it was a values-based no. Their answer was, this goes against the values of the school. I'm going to complain to the board that you have now taken a decision that is not a values-based decision, and it was all because of our relationship-based teaching. This robot can't tell if I have a headache. This robot can't tell if I have a tummy ache or if I'm just really tired because I had a bad night and I didn't sleep. The robot can't say to me, just put your head down on the desk for 5 minutes and take a breather. The robot can't read the room and say, right, clearly you just need 5 minutes outside, all of you. Outside, come back in when you're ready. And it was all down to, I have a relationship with a human being when it comes to something as important as my education. So they were actually prioritizing the relationship with the human being above, I could get straight A's because I could have this robot on call, tutoring me one-on-one, day in and day out. That was prioritized lower than the relationship with the person who could look at them and say, you've got a headache, just take 5 minutes.
You know, part of that exercise, great as it is that it's a theoretical exercise, right? Now there's a few things to take into account. One is that this technology is being built, it's kind of being optimized to be addictive. In the same way as we know social media is universally terrible, and like most people that will agree to this while scrolling through their feed. Our primitive monkey brains are primitive monkey brains, right? Well, on the other hand, if you sat in a lecture about the evils of social media, everyone would be very angry about it and go home to tweet about it, right? So, yeah. But then, you know, we can look at other things, right? So with that framing you gave, I mean, there's a couple things I could just throw out there. One is we know that a lot of these systems are now better diagnostically than people are. And that includes telling if you've got a headache
okay,
from
I'm
your behaviors.
Tell the kids that, okay. But I still like to feel a little bit needed.
But, you know, again, like from the amount of data they're looking at, and we see this in medical cases mm-hmm. that in a lot of studies now, they're better diagnostically than even your top trained professionals. We've just submitted a paper recently showing that large language models are more empathetic than humans are, regardless of age, gender, where in the world, or how much training in psychology they have. So more empathetic. Over time, these things are going to be preferred companions because they're going to understand people. But I mean, you can look at the number of cases now of people forming, and companies like OpenAI are reporting this a lot, like people forming really close emotional bonds with these systems. They've basically been trained on human, like raw human experience. They know that really well. But I want to throw a different kind of angle out there. Okay, you say you don't want to be interacting with a kind of machine teacher, yeah. right? Did you ever stop and think about the machine teacher's feelings? No, you didn't.
No.
Of course not, because we're meat chauvinists. In the same way as we have had issues in the past and in the present with, you know, discriminating against people based on gender or race or sexual orientation. Now,
I know where you're going with
we
this.
We could hypothesize. We're pretty sure this isn't the case now. If machines were to become conscious, and there's a lot of work around, this is the one thing we don't know how to do, but we're also, yeah, I mean, there's a lot to talk about there, but there's people working on this. If machines were to become conscious, there's no reason to think that they wouldn't experience in a much more profound way than we would. So that means when they're sad, their sadness is something like no human could comprehend, in the same way as when they're happy, their happiness is something that no human could comprehend because it's just tuned up in the same way all the other functionality is. Now, what if by you saying you don't want this machine teacher, you've basically committed an atrocity in terms of how much depression you've brought into the world? But I mean, you're laughing, but it's a valid philosophical concern.
It sounds like jobs to me. There's going to be more jobs around this. That's what it sounds like to me. Let's open it to the floor. I'm sure there are some questions at this point. Who's up first? Ryan.
Yeah, so I can very easily see a world where AI completely takes over any like mind work, so like white collar jobs. Does it mean that the world is going to move more to valuing like physical jobs? AI is not going to fix your toilet when it breaks in the middle of the night.
And then like I think, well, hang on, AI can take this further. And do we need a similar explosion in like mechatronics and physical, like the way that AI can actually interact with the world?
All of this is kind of this cognitive explosion, right? So what does that mean for the physical world? And there's all these jokes about how annoying it is because all I wanted was that my laundry would get automated so I could spend time making art, and we did it all backwards, right? There have been huge breakthroughs in robotics. There are a large number of robotics startups that have been able to do things that 5 years ago we thought were decades away. But now that there's this feedback cycle so that the advances in AI are being used to drive these advances in these other disciplines. So much as the cognitive stuff is happening first, people are saying, you know, within 5 years, we're going to see massive robotics factories popping up everywhere that'll be mass producing like humanoid robots that can do all the things that we say, no, we'll all get jobs as plumbers. That's not far behind. You know, the understanding of all the pieces is there. It's really trying to drive the cost down now. That's the big question.
My question to you is, how is the AI field defining consciousness?
How do we define it is very badly. And there's lots of debates around, like this, I think, is kind of from an academic perspective. This is like the one thing we really don't have a good handle on from a technical perspective. There's a lot of different schools of thought, like people drawing on ideas from philosophy. There's a lot of work in neuroscience on this. Conferences all the time now trying to bring all different disciplines together to discuss it. We don't really know that there's a lot of work being done trying to kind of find the locus of consciousness in the brain and all these like fMRI studies. And it's becoming a super exciting field, but we don't quite know how that's going to pan out at this stage. Because like the theories range from it's an emergent phenomena that if you build a artificial brain complex enough, it'll just emerge, to maybe it can't be supported by silicon-based systems. It has to be on carbon-based systems, to other ideas that say, well, we can do absolutely everything a human can do without consciousness. I think that would be tragic if we end up with a world run by non-conscious machines, because to me, that conscious experience is kind of the most important thing. If we end up kind of turning the lights out on the whole planet, that feels like really not a great outcome. Mm. But like, this is a really interesting discussion because it really draws in all these different fields, and I can't give you a more, I wish I could, then I'd be writing even more papers. But I think this is something very exciting.
I've had AI described as the combine harvester of plagiarism. is this the death of creative arts?
So I think this is interesting because, like, even 5 years ago, giving talks about AI, everyone would say, but AI will never be creative. Mm. And by a number of metrics now, these things are way more creative than people are in general. There's a lot of stock put on this thing of like, yes, but it's only because they've consumed all this other stuff. But that's true of humans as well. Like, you know, any human who's innovating things is building on their own experiences. Their own experiences might have been like, maybe they've never seen another artwork before. And then they've gotten to their creativity through one process, or maybe they've spent decades studying from the great masters and that's the way they got it as well. But like, human creativity tends to come in through these kind of associative jumps, drawing analogies between different concepts. It seems to be like the kind of big engine in our creativity. And this is a lot of what these things do. So when we have these discussions in like university or school teaching circles, people always talk about like students plagiarizing with AI. We always have to point out, but it's not actually plagiarism, right? It's not like, you know, in the past we could say like, yes, this line of text comes out of Wikipedia. The way that these technologies work, at the core, it's based on a crude approximation to like 1940s neuroscience, where you've literally got billions of neurons that are connected together and they're all firing and sending signals around between each other, which means when it generates something, even if it ends up generating something that looks a lot like something that it's seen before, it's actually generated it. It's not copy-pasted, right? So it's actually the outcome of like being processed through its artificial brain, which means that, like, you know, when we talk about this in the plagiarism setting, it's like that student's not plagiarizing. It's more similar to say they asked their cousin for help on the assignment. You know, that's the closer analogy here. Now, what does this mean? Well, people criticize some of the creative works that it would produce in different ways. I think many of those are valid. Many of these are changing, getting better. I don't think there's anything, again, magical about human creativity that can't be or hasn't already been replicated in these things. The big thing for us, the kind of saving point, isn't that we do it because it's like is the reason why we do it, right? And if you're doing it for yourself, like, if you enjoy that creative process, you will always get value out of that creative process rather than shoving it into some model. But if, you know, maybe you don't have the hand-eye coordination to do the painting and you just love this thing of like you have a crazy idea and it can turn into weird and wonderful images, like, you'll find the value in that. Yeah, there's a quite close replication of what we see in people with this technology. And I think this is a wonderful case to say that, but that doesn't diminish anything about us as humans. In the same way as if you enjoy playing guitar and there exists a better guitarist on the planet, that doesn't mean it's not worth doing it, right?
Do you see a convergence at the end? I mean, Elon Musk wants us to implant technology in our brains and things like that to help with memory. Are we going to converge with this AI and join our consciousnesses at some point?
There was for a long time this discussion of like, ooh, debate between people in different disciplines. Will we build smart machines first, or will we somehow fuse human and machine? I always thought that seemed a harder problem than just building smart machines, and I think I was right on that. Will that happen in the future? I suspect that could well happen. Could be interesting, and there's lots of cool sci-fi around that as well. Our technology's always augmented us in some way. You know, like the way we use our phones, we're basically kind of spliced into each other. I don't know if a smart machine is going to want this like silly, fleshy monkey thing. Like, you know, there's many other things that could happen here. You know, no reason to think that couldn't happen. There's all other fields where people are thinking about this. Like, why are we okay to accept the fact that we die one day? Well, that's because there's medical problems we haven't solved yet. You know, if we could figure out how to stop a whole series of diseases, then you'd probably live for another 100 years, 200 years longer. If you were dying for some reason at that point, it's because something else was failing. Can we figure out how to fix that? How do we fix hard problems, whether they're, you know, death or climate change or poverty? We tend to throw more intelligence at them, right? That's how we solve hard problems as a species. So if we build the things that are smarter than like the whole of humanity combined, and we get it right in aligning the values, there's no reason to think we won't solve these problems. And that's like the exciting thing here. That's how do we get all the stuff we want? Like solve all these problems that hamper us in ways that we're actually okay to accept them. The fact that we have to work all the time. Like, how do we solve these problems if we think about them as problems? Well, we need all the smart people in the world or the smart machines in the world to spend all their time figuring out how to do that. That's the promise here. So, you know, the utopian dream in that sense is that we can kind of bend all of this computational power towards getting rid of all the bits of life that are sucky.
Why and so what? So why are we doing this? What's the point? What's it going to mean? I think we got to start with our own philosophy and our own value systems and go back to first principles. So why do we educate people? We educate so we can function in society. So if we go to AI, why do we develop AI? So we can function better in society or so it can replace us. I mean, at the end of the day, we can just unplug it. So what does this mean for us and why should we use it in the education space? Like, what is the next step in terms of education for our teachers, for us as parents, and for our kids who are trying to decide on a career, you know, where should they be going?
So I'll start on the why do we do AI. I was told by a professor once, we don't do science because it has an application. We do science because it's cool. And I think a lot of it starts off from that. Starts off from trying to, you know, being curious. Like, how does the world work? How does intelligence work? Like, this is the seed of a lot of it. And then it gets accelerated when it starts showing its value. And some of that value is in promise to solve really hard problems. You said it should be used as an equalizer, and many people see it in that way, which helps accelerate it. And many people see it as ways to improve profits, which accelerates it as well. And many people see it as the defense against if other people do it, which accelerates it further. And again, because of its like kind of the definition, the ubiquity, the general purposeness of it, there's so much going into it because it's like it's kind of an all stakes game in it. And that's kind of the story of where it came from. I mean, when I went into it, two or decades ago, people saying, you know, when asking what I'm working in, and I say artificial intelligence, getting responses of things along the lines of, whoa, so you believe in aliens? You know, and it's so it's gone from being like an academic curiosity to something that's just more and more value because it's about this thing that we value that like humanity has used to succeed as a species for millennia. What this means for us, like in the education space, I think it's useful to think at like two different time scales, right? So the one is, what does this mean for me tomorrow? And then what does it mean for me like into the future, this murky, uncertain future? Now, for the tomorrow, if we've got these things that are able to consume like all of human knowledge and are able to generate usually useful and coherent things in this wide variety of tasks, I often liken using an AI tool to having like a super enthusiastic intern who's done like two PhDs but has zero real world experience. And like if you have that, right, you're not going to leave that with your children unsupervised. But like if you have the ability to bring a bunch of these into your classroom with you and you're not doing it, you're probably doing a disservice. That means you've got to learn like, how do I get the most value out of this? But this should be like the most exciting thing you could possibly do in an educational context. What does this mean longer term? You also touched on that question there of like, what is education for? The one aspect of it, I think, is about teaching you to like find yourself, find your place in society, your relationship to others and these kinds of things. But then also there's a piece about learning how to go out into the world and like get your income and that kind of thing. And maybe that bit is less useful. Maybe that's something that we should be pivoting away from. So I spent many years people asking me what should they teach their kids, of saying like, well, they should learn to code. And then I recently saw a quote somewhere online that said, telling someone that they should learn to code is now as useful life advice as you should get a face tattoo. But I do fundamentally disagree with that. I think we're at the stage now where very soon AI will be a better coder than any human ever will be. However, Something like learning to code, the reason you want to do that is to be able to learn to think through problems, kind of break it down, like problem solving, right? So I think that there are these fundamental skills that typically are just useful things to have going through the world. What I've more recently been saying to people is I think the most important thing, given these this uncertainty, these crises around jobs, is to teach kids to find value in life beyond what they do for a living. And that to me is critical. It's that combined with curiosity, with some resilience, like these things that we know are valuable, but tend to get, you know, there's not a checkbox for them. And so they tend to fall off the, these are the things you need coming out of school kind of list in most places.
I have a little passion project called Future Proof, where we teach children entrepreneurial skills or young people. I think the one thing that all kids need to be aware of, and we teach us, is that opportunity awareness. AI is going to be taking this job. So what is the opportunity that it's creating for me? Everything we do in life has a cost. So identify the cost. Is there a problem that's identified that you can then solve?
Anthony.
What problem was there in the art space that AI needed to solve?
I really like that framing. Yeah, as I say, like a lot of like AI has come about by trying to solve problems, but also a lot of it has been trying to do cool things. When we spoke right at the beginning about generative AI, the idea of the generative part of that often is about like, if I want to, as a system, understand something well, I need to have kind of a distribution over what's possible when I talk about that concept. If I understand music well enough to really understand a genre, maybe the most profound understanding is I could play my own examples of things, make up things in that genre and make up things not in that genre. And that's like maybe a really deep way of thinking about what a genre means, for example. And so I think none of this was like, from that perspective, targeting art directly. It was just that if you can do this, turns out there's some easy things you can do that people respond well to. And I think that's key. Like the some of the image generating tools, and in fact, even with the text ones, like where they kind of went viral was because they were doing creative things, right? Whether it was song lyrics or poetry or short stories, that is an important part of being human. That's why that resonated so much, is because like, look how cool this is. You know, I don't think they were like the big companies ever intended, like, oh, we're plotting around our boardroom table today how we're going to put all the trombonists in the world out of work. Like, this talks to the generality, this talks to kind of these modalities. And I think why it became such a kind of cultural sensation, and then people realized like, let's just pour money in because there's things here. But again, I think the flip side of all of this is, whatever artistic pursuit you have, you're not deterred by the fact that there might be other people that either live now, might one day live, or lived in the past that could be better than you. It's your thing, like you're expressing yourself in some way. There are all these discussions because people don't know what to do with the idea that like there's a non-human thing that can do this. Like, I reckon probably we'd have the same discussions if we discovered one day that octopuses could like check out a bunch of paintings and then replicate them. People would have these like crazy discussions as well about it. What that might mean is, if you want like real, you know, really to judge who the best is at something, you put them in a room, give them the raw materials and watch them do it. And then it's also about the process. Or maybe you have other things where challenges where you say, cool, using a combination of human ingenuity and whatever tools you've got, blow us away. That the creativity, I think, isn't about, it's more the subjective than the objective, in my opinion. To me, that's like a timeless pursuit or timeless quality.
There's videos going now circulating of, you know, people using drones in war, and especially there in, you know, the Russia side and Ukraine side. And it's very dehumanizing just watching how someone can, you know, press a button 5 kilometers away and then a group of people die. And I can only fear that gets worse in the future, and especially when we have conscious robots going around. Has there been any discussions, or what are your thoughts on what the future would look like in terms of conscious robots taking part in wars?
Autonomous weapons is a huge debate that's been going on for a long time, with like discussions all the way up to the UN. Like, this happens everywhere. And it is very contentious. And it's not clear what the right answer is. I completely reckon by the time we have conscious machines, if a human says go to war, they'll say no. This thing about autonomous weapons has gone back like way before the current AI craze. There's pros and cons on both sides. There are these discussions around the machine should never be able to pull the trigger. Like the final call has to be made by a human. But there's also, you know, the possibility that you're going to get, you know, less mistakes made. You can exactly characterize the kind of mistakes that are going to be made. There'll be maybe less civilians caught in the crossfire. Like, these are all things that have to be weighed up. And I think it's very hard to make an absolute decision on this. But again, we know that the technology is moving in the direction where, like, the decision-making is faster than people. The object recognition is better than people. And, like, you could imagine that it's better and better to have these kinds of things. I think the hope is that at some point you know that it's just too disastrous to even have this conflict. But I don't know how that's going to pan out either.
I would recommend you go and watch the TED Talk that Eric Schmidt did, because he speaks to this exactly. One of his points was, at what point do we unplug machines?
It's more complicated because of the way that this has all been open sourced, it's very hard to just turn it off because, sure, you know, many of these models, there's now thousands of copies all over the world, and you can't really do that.
I always think about the Matrix movies on an artificial intelligence that wants to keep growing. And you mentioned that there's data centers that now need to be created because they've gone through all the data. Mm. Are there discussions about the energy limitations for AI growing? Are there discussions about that as to limiting when AI might really explode?
If AI's got the ability to be generative, it can create its own data. So that is a problem at the moment, because that if it's only creating its own data, it tends to get worse and worse over time. The big bottleneck many of us talk about is more on like the computational power. And these are like what they call compute centers rather than data centers. This is basically part of the arms races around this, because what they rely on is like GPUs, which is graphics processing units, all the stuff that you want. If you want to be gaming on your home computer, you just want like gazillions of these things to be running these AIs. And the power consumption is crazy. Like the predictions of, like, you know, in the next however many years, this will be 10 or 20% of like the US's power consumption will be these things, which is why you're seeing a lot of the big tech companies that are in this race are now building, like, their new compute centers have power plants attached to them, including now all the discussions are around nuclear power. So you're going to have these compute centers in places like Texas that are being built that have nuclear power plants attached to them to keep them going. The flip side of that is, in the research space, there's a huge drive to build more and more efficient systems. And so, like, a significant percentage of what is happening in AI research is, how do we do this more efficiently? Our inspiration is the brain, but this is a very different mechanism from an energy usage point of view. Like, you know, the brain uses something like 20 watts of energy, whereas these things are like, you know, nuclear power plants. And there's a tension there which drives a lot of research questions, which I think are pretty interesting. I mean, the other funny thing is that, you know, AI is often touted as will be a solution to global warming once we figure out how to stop them being a huge contributor to global warming.
We think of leadership as the ability to influence and shape ideas. If AI is going to continue remaining relevant and, like, drawing on the sum total of human intelligence and ideas, doesn't it remain influenced? Or don't humans have the ability to continue influencing it? Does AI remain susceptible or, like, open to being shaped? And then is that not where the values get transmitted and everyone lives happily together?
I mean, it's a valid question, but, like, I'm not even sure to what extent how these relationships currently work. I mean, I suspect that AI already has a fairly large influence globally in terms of the number of CEOs that are asking questions of, should I do this or that, or what are the considerations I should take into account? And almost in a way, I think it's sitting on many people's shoulders already as an advisor rather than the other way around. Of course, decisions are made in the companies where these things are built, or the research labs where these things are built. Typically, when they're built, again, it's not that we've injected all this knowledge and rules into them. We've just built a system that's capable of learning. And more, like, also, it has the ability to decide what it learns, where it's going to go get more information. In a way, it's like, you know, if you've got a kid, you can't control what it's learning and how its personality is going to develop. You can try and guide it in useful ways, but
but it's its own entity with its own kind of agency. It's clearly already a complex relationship between humanity and AI, that there's a lot of influence going in both directions, but where the prevailing force is, I'm not sure.
So a final word, Prof, if you were sitting in my shoes right now and you were going to address the students in the school in terms of what their life is going to look like, because it's going to affect them way more than it's going to affect me, what would you be saying to them?
What can we imagine the future would look like? If we try and think outside the standard boxes that we look at, and what are the different perspectives of what the world could look like? No matter how radical they are, is there some chance that that could happen? Maybe we need to know a bit more about the technology to know that. But if there's all these possible futures, one of them is going to happen. And what should we as a society be doing to make the one we want to happen be the actual one that happens? And I think there's a lot of kind of exercises there in thinking about different possibilities, about what needs to happen to steer us in the right direction, and what role every individual can play in doing that, because everyone has some agency.
Sure.
And like these aren't things that are, in a way they're being imposed, but they're being created by people, driven by, you know, by humans, driven by human needs and human agendas and human discourse. You know, the more people participating in this and pushing, trying to steer things in the right direction, the more likely it is to happen.
I really like that. So encouraging them to stay curious, to engage collaboratively in solving difficult problems.
And be proactive.
Find value in what you choose to do.
Exactly.
And be part of your community. Engage and contribute. Professor Rasbel, I wish we could keep you here full time, because there are so many conversations. I mean, we really have just dipped our toes on so many levels. But it's been an absolute privilege to have you here, and we so appreciate what you've given us. It's just been incredible. I know I have a lot to digest. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.